This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Ships filled with wheat are again leaving Ukraine. The head of the World Trade Organization is cautiously optimistic for countries in desperate need.
There are glimmers of hope, but we are on a knife's edge in terms of the potential risks that could upset us.
Also today, for Saudis on Twitter, criticizing their government is risky.
I get threats on a daily basis on Twitter from these Saudi accounts that are pro-government.
It's not only threats, harsh jail sentences are being handed down. And in Ghana, trying to convince people to get vaccinated for COVID, some health officials there can spend a whole day in a community and won't get a single person to take a shot.
It's frustrating us. People somewhere will think maybe we are not doing our best, but we are putting in our best.
And slowly, some progress. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. Some glimmers of good news from Ukraine these days. Cargo ships are finally cruising through the Black Sea. At least 18 vessels loaded with grain have left Ukraine in the past 2 weeks. It is a sign that global cooperation can work to ease trade, even in an active war zone. But navigating through ports blocked by mines and military vessels is not easy. And there are new accusations that Russia is smuggling grain from Ukraine's occupied territories. To find out what the renewed shipments mean for global trade and the world's food crisis, we reached out to Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. She is the Director General of the World Trade Organization. Director, few people have a better grip on world trade than you. Were you surprised to see the shipments leaving Ukrainian ports with some regularity?
Marco, let me say that I'm not so surprised because a lot of groundwork had gone into this. Remember the UN Secretary General, Turkey, and others had worked with Russia and Ukraine to make this happen. So these are very good signs. We are cautiously optimistic and hope this will continue, but we are not past the worst.
So at least 18 shiploads of grain have left Ukraine, as I said. Can you give us your assessment of what that volume really represents? Does it begin to meet the needs of hungry people, especially in low-income countries?
It's definitely making a difference. If you look at what is happening to price of grain, for instance, the FAO, Food and Agricultural Organization, cereal price index has dropped by almost 12% in July compared to June. And the vegetable oil price index has dropped by 19%. So that means that cereal prices, vegetable oil prices, both essentials, are coming down. You know, but they're still well above their levels in July of 2021. It's good to see that a shipment left for the port of Djibouti, destined for consumers in Ethiopia, and we hope within 2 weeks they will begin to get access. And there are other shipments that will benefit people in Africa. So this is promising.
As you well know, it's not just about ships getting to their destination. At the same time, there's been drought across Europe. Add to that just the sheer tumult of war in Ukraine, plus a strong dollar and inflation. Do you think that's going to mean that some countries just won't be able to get all the food that their people need?
It means that there are significant risks because we have 345 million people in 82 countries who are facing food insecurity, with 50 million people, according to the World Food Program, who are on the edge of famine. But continuing to see these ships leaving is really the most important indicator. We have the droughts. Climate change is a big problem. But I think alleviating the pressure from the war in Ukraine will be very, very significant.
So with the deal that allowed some of that Ukrainian grain to leave ports, there were parallel stipulations that allowed Russia to export some goods that had been targeted under the Western sanctions regime. What has that part of the deal to open Ukraine's ports meant, actually, for Russian exports?
Well, let's put it this way. As you know, the Black Sea region, Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus are very significant with respect to agriculture. And that means also agricultural inputs like fertilizer. So the fact that Russia is also able to export fertilizer to nations that need it helps, because we've got to think not only of this immediate food crisis, getting food to people, but also how are they going to grow food for next year? And African countries have the capacity to grow their own food, but if they don't get access to inputs like fertilizer, then yields will be significantly down. Even agricultural powerhouses like Brazil need this access.
What do we know about these accusations that Russia is smuggling Ukrainian grain out of occupied territories?
It's very difficult for me to actually comment on this particular issue. I think that has to be left to people on the ground who can monitor these kinds of movements.
Director General, 25 million tons of grain are still stuck in Ukrainian warehouses. Can much of that get to those who need it before it spoils?
I would certainly hope so, Marco. We've had 20 million tons of grain in warehouses. We have another 25 million tons to be harvested. And so it will be a really huge shame for the world if this grain is allowed to spoil when we have hundreds of millions of hungry people in the world.
I mean, just generally, what has the war in Ukraine meant for global trade?
More than 25% of wheat exports for the world, vegetable oil, other agricultural products come from this region. So whilst it may look like, okay, the impact on total world trade is not that much, but the impact on a very important sector of trade, food and agriculture, is heavy. And so you've seen the IMF and the World Bank downgrade their forecasts for world growth. We've also done the same with respect to world trade. There's talk of rationing of gas in Europe. All of these have huge implications for trade and for people who are going hungry in the world.
I mean, if we can shine a little light on some optimistic news, there does seem to be at least a slight global trade rebound in recent months. Some of the supply chain problems seem to be easing. Ships are starting to move again. But how can that rebound be made more inclusive so it benefits both high and low-income countries?
Well, you're absolutely right, Marco. There are some signs of supply chain easing. We've seen the cost of shipping freight drop by as much as 70% on some routes. And we've also seen the time it takes to ship freight from China to the U.S. West Coast, for instance, declining from about 113 days at the start of this year to about 95 days now. So these are good signs. But we've still got the issue of China's zero COVID policy, which could lead to further supplier shutdowns. We've got the gas shortages in Europe, and this winter could lead to the slowing down of industrial production there. You've seen the New York Fed, which has an index, also note that supply chain pressures remain at historically high levels, with which we agree. So, yes, there are glimmers of hope, but we are on a knife's edge in terms of the potential risks that could upset us.
Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is the Director General of the World Trade Organization. Director General, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Marco.
In Saudi Arabia, a university student has been given a 34-year prison sentence. Salma al-Shahab was convicted for tweeting posts that the kingdom's leaders did not like. Al-Shahab was arrested last year while traveling to the kingdom from the UK to visit her family. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, this is not the first time Saudi Arabia has punished a critic who posted online.
Salma al-Shahab was initially given 6 years in prison for posting what the Saudi court documents describe as spreading rumors. It said that through her Twitter post, al-Shahab had disturbed the public order and destabilized the social fabric of the kingdom. When Shahab appealed her sentence, it was increased to 34 years, which was announced this week. The news has rattled many in Saudi Arabia and abroad. It even got the attention of the U.S. State Department. Spokesman Ned Price told reporters yesterday that the U.S. is studying Shahab's case.
Freedom of expression is a principle that we stand up for around the world. Anytime, any government, anywhere tramples on such a principle, we speak out and we seek to defend that fundamental right.
Saudi Arabia has a history of cracking down on activists and influential figures based on their social media posts, especially Twitter, says Abdullah Al-Oda, a Saudi dissident living in the U.S. More so, he says, after the current crown prince, also known as MBS, rose to power in 2017.
Saudi society does not have any kind of elected parliament. They go to Twitter to express themselves, to use this as a public sphere. And since MBS came to power, he wanted to completely shut down every aspect of the public sphere that once existed.
Al-Oda says Twitter is popular among Saudis, and the royal family has made investments in the company, and that gives them leverage. One man, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, owns roughly 5% of the company.
They use every algorithms and tricks in order to control hashtags, trendings on Twitter. And thirdly, they created the Saudi automated accounts, or what we call bots or flies.
These bots or flies, he says, monitor Saudi accounts. And in the case of Salma al-Shahab, a Twitter user reported her tweets to authorities using an app called Kullana Aman, or We Are All Safe in Arabic.
Kullana Aman is not a new application.
Noura Al-Juzabi is a researcher at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. The lab researches and identifies digital threats against civil society.
Kullana Aman, similar to the other policing applications in the region, were introduced to the public that now you can easily report to the law enforcement about any kind of abuse. In addition to taking screenshot, they can send a voice memo, they can send a link.
Al-Juzabi says this is part of what she calls digital authoritarianism, where citizens of countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, or Egypt can be monitored and silenced, even if they live outside the country.
These applications are making and enabling the role of individuals in the digital repression.
And as the case of Al-Shahab shows, getting reported can have serious consequences. Besides the 34-year sentence, the University of Leeds student is banned from traveling outside Saudi Arabia. The story of Al-Shahab hits close to home for Abdullah Al-Oda in D.C.
My own father was arrested in September 2017 because he tweeted during the blockade on Qatar, a tweet in which he called for reconciliation between the two countries.
Al-Oda's father, a 65-year-old, is still in prison and he faces the death penalty. His sentence is still pending. Al-Oda himself is getting threats too. Noura Al-Juzabi of Citizen Lab has researched how online threats against dissidents can translate into physical attacks.
Besides the digital repression, they were also subjected to another offline threats, whether assassination attempts or other means of threats.
Twitter didn't respond to an interview request for this story, but last week, a former employee of the company was convicted of spying for the Saudi government. Ahmed Abu Amun monitored and gathered personal information of political dissidents and passed it to Saudi officials. A Twitter security executive said the investigation prompted a security overhaul at Twitter, and the company has tried to clamp down on the number of employees who have access to sensitive information. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
In Kabul today, at least 21 people were killed and 33 more wounded. Worshippers were gathered for evening prayers at a mosque in Afghanistan's capital when a bomb went off. No group immediately claimed responsibility for the atrocity, but ISIS has stepped up attacks since the Taliban took control of the country a year ago. Asfandiar Mir is a senior analyst at the U.S. Institute of Peace, focused on political violence in South Asia. He says that ISIS uses high-profile attacks to get noticed.
And it's more likely to attract other jihadists in the region and beyond, and that such violence is the way for it to claim the mantle of the leadership of jihad.
Monday on the show, we'll hear more about the power contest playing out in Afghanistan and who is truly in control a year after the Taliban takeover. Coming up next on the show, Greece and Turkey both refuse responsibility for some of the tiny islands on their shared border. The consequences for migrants stranded on those islands is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Migrants trying to leave places like Syria are legally allowed to apply for asylum in Europe if they can make it to the continent. Increasingly, though, they're being expelled from Europe before they can even file a case. The practice is known as pushback. Human rights groups are broadly condemning it. This month, one pushback ended in tragedy when a 5-year-old girl died on an island between Turkey and Greece. As the world's Duri Baskaran reports from Istanbul, that death fits a pattern of abuses against asylum seekers.
The voice was shaky, almost halting, but persistent.
I am Baida, Syria. I am 27 years old, and I'm on an island on the Greek-Turkish border with 39 people, including my grandmother.
For weeks, a young Syrian refugee named Baida sent voice messages to journalists, like this one that aired on Britain's Channel 4. Her attorney asked us not to share her last name for her safety. Drinking river water and surviving on scraps foraged from the island, she begged for the group to be rescued, says Georgos Christides of Der Spiegel.
She was doing everything in her power to mobilize the media, the authorities, the lawyers.
The island was full of snakes and scorpions, Baida said. She feared for the safety of the group's 8 children and 2 pregnant women.
No one wants us. No one hears us. No one wants to help.
Attorneys quickly won a ruling from the European Court of Human Rights that demanded that Greek authorities rescue the group. They've issued rulings like this for about 500 people in the past 4 months, says Lefteris Papaniakis of the Greek Council for Refugees.
They say that Greece has to grant them water, access to medical health, etc., and not remove them. Save them, give them water, food, shelter, and don't push them back.
But on the day of the deadline, instead of rescuing them, Greek police appeared to have forced the group off of the island and back into Turkish territory. In Turkey, Baida reported in her messages, the group was arrested by Turkish patrols, who then forced them back onto the island in the middle of the river at gunpoint. On August 8th, Baida sent another message in a panic.
She's dead and she's lived forever.
A 5-year-old girl named Maria had died on the island after being stung by a scorpion.
I can do nothing. And no one can do nothing. Please, can you help us in any way?
The story hit the international press. Greece's opposition party demanded answers in parliament. But for almost a week after Maria's death, Greek police refused to rescue the group. They said that they couldn't locate the refugees, even though Baida sent GPS coordinates of the island, says Georgos Christides, the journalist.
They shared live locations through WhatsApp. They shared photographs and videos that we were able to geolocate with precision.
Greek police did not assist the refugees until the group secured a boat and floated to the Greek side of the river.
They reported death of a girl and all that for them to be rescued.
Imagine what happens to everyone else, Christides says. Greek Migration Minister Notis Mitarachi went to visit the group after the rescue. Afterwards, in TV appearances, he said that the group had never been on Greek soil. The island was on Turkish territory, he insisted. The group was pushed towards Greece by Turkish authorities. But Turkey maintains that the island is Greek. Despite widespread documentation of pushbacks, the Greek government has never formally acknowledged them. But Maria is not the first refugee to die this way. On an island, in the middle of a river, between 2 countries and within shouting distance of both shores. Even for those who survive the ordeal, it's a harrowing experience. In April, I traveled to Edirne, a city on the Turkish border, with Josur, a small civil rights group that tracks abuses against migrants.
So people suffered a lot after pushback. They don't have food, they don't have anything.
Amin is a Tunisian social worker. We're withholding his last name due to legal issues faced by Josur. He takes me to a safe house for people who have been pushed back from the Greek and Bulgarian borders. A Kurdish family from Syria sits together in a small room, looking shell-shocked. Anut Malar, the mother, explained that she, her 10-year-old son Dildar, and a male relative had crossed the river from Turkey into Bulgaria. Malar tells me they were arrested by Bulgarian police after they crossed. They were taken to a warehouse and strip-searched. Their cell phones, cash, and legal documents were confiscated. After a few days in custody, they were brought back to the river that divides Turkey and Bulgaria and forced to cross back into Turkey. Malar says she's been pushed back like this 7 times. Sometimes she and her son are beaten by border patrols during the arrest. I asked her why she keeps trying. Syria is totally destroyed, she says. We're trying to get anywhere safe, where I can give my son a good life and a good education after all of this. Migrant rights groups say EU countries are using pushbacks as part of a strategy to reduce the number of refugees within their borders. Though the number of refugees arriving from the south hasn't changed much in recent years, the number of people dying on these routes has shot up. I visited the river that divides Turkey and Greece in April with Natalie Gruber, JoSOAR's director.
All you see is a really beautiful river with a nice landscape around.
Gruber says something changed in 2020. Greek police will push people back to Turkey, and then Turkish police will force them back to Greece, Gruber says, like a sick game of ping pong. Eventually, some groups end up on one of the many islands in the middle of the river, like 5-year-old Maria did, where both Turkey and Greece can plausibly argue it's not their territory.
Which is basically just a sandbank with some trees. It's not the proper island, and when the water level rises, it gets flooded.
It's her anger at the injustice of it all that keeps her going.
To know that we are systematically disappearing people, killing people on our borders just for having been born in the wrong place.
And that the world just accepts it.
Because Europe has successfully managed to paint itself as this beacon of human rights, and that is incredible hypocrisy to me.
Gruber's work trying to help refugees while documenting these pushbacks angered the Greek government, which accused JoSOAR of espionage. Though it never went to court, their names were leaked to the press, staining the group's reputation and scaring funders away. This summer, Gruber's team was finally forced to cease operations, leaving a big blind spot for aid groups along the Greece-Turkey border, and fewer places for refugees like Baida to call for help. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin in Istanbul.
Our coverage of global migration continues online, where you can find more of Derry's reporting about daily concerns for Syrian migrants in Turkey. Random ID checks in immigrant neighborhoods of Istanbul have led to some of the 19,000 deportations this year. That's according to city officials. Syrians deported back to their country that remains under control of militias and government forces. You can find that story and others at theworld.org. More news and stories from around the globe coming your way just ahead. You're listening to The World. When war hit Ukraine, parts of daily life simply stopped, like schooling.
I was supposed to have an English exam. I was preparing for that exam, and then the next day, that all just disappeared. You were figuring out what is more valuable to put in your rucksack to take with you.
Now, American educators are stepping up, offering online classes to Ukrainian students. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The European Union is hosting meetings today between Kosovo and Serbia. The sit-downs come after tensions have been on the rise between the Balkan neighbors. Recall that Kosovo was formerly part of Serbia. It broke away in 1999 and declared independence in 2008. Serbia has never recognized Kosovo and views it as a breakaway region. To find out more about the current tensions, Jasmin Miljanovic is on the line with us from Los Angeles. He's a Balkans political analyst and author. The Balkans are so multi-layered with history and strife, Jasmin, but what specifically set off these tensions between Serbia and Kosovo that now need some mediating by the EU? How'd they start?
Well, it's difficult to pin down exactly where this current round of tensions began. There's any number of places that we could look to, including really sort of minute issues like a license plate regime between the two countries that would allow persons from Kosovo to travel into Serbia with appropriate Kosovo-issued license plates. The structural and the fundamental issue is that Belgrade does not recognize Kosovo's sovereignty. What we have in Serbia is an increasingly nationalist and autocratic government that has been kind of itching and spoiling for a fight with Kosovo for quite a while.
So, as you said, it can be small details around things like license plates. From what I've seen in some reports, both Serbia and Kosovo agreed to that plan for Kosovo to no longer recognize Serbian license plates within its borders. So what happened?
This is at least the second time that Kosovo has tried to formally initiate the realization of this new license plate policy regime, which it has done according to the rules of the agreement. Once it has tried to do that, Serbia on two occasions now has responded with very, very severe political escalation.
So Yasmin, assess for us how bad tensions are right now between Kosovo and Serbia. And do you think this meeting with the EU in Brussels will actually solve anything?
From what I hear, the meeting has already ended without any kind of breakthrough. It's fair to say that relations between Pristina and Belgrade are at a real nadir. They're the worst that they've been in a very, very long time. Serbia's current government has been very, very explicit about the fact that it has this so-called Serbian world foreign policy, which it pursues in the Western Balkans, which is very reminiscent of the so-called Russian world policy, i.e. that Serbia seeks to, as it claims, protect the interests of ethnic Serb communities throughout the Western Balkans. And this has brought it into conflict with virtually all of its neighbors, but above all with Kosovo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Montenegro. The three governments of those countries have consistently accused Serbia of, again, kind of systematically interfering in their sovereign affairs, fomenting unrest, supporting secessionist forces, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, there's no doubt we've seen a rise in Serbian nationalism in the Balkans in recent years, even more so as tensions have been on the rise in Eastern Europe following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Is Russia playing a role in the tension between Kosovo and Serbia?
I mean, it is, and it has been for a very long time because, of course, Russia is Serbia's chief international backer in the dispute. Indeed, the regime of Vladimir Putin has even in the past used the example of Kosovo, or what it calls the precedent of Kosovo, to justify its illegal annexation of Crimea and its occupation and aggression against parts of Ukraine that we're still presently witnessing.
It is so complex in the Balkans between ethnic, national, and religious identities. I mean, we saw what happened in the 1990s. Do you think there is a way to navigate all these factors in the Balkans and create a path to a place where everyone, like in Kosovo and in Serbia, feels satisfied or respected?
What people across the region, including in Serbia, really fundamentally want is just for the international community, and in particular the US and the EU, to abide by its own values and its own principles when they conduct themselves or they engage in policy initiatives in the Western Balkans. That is to say, to support liberal democracy, to support human rights, to support minority rights, and to support individual rights above all, so that we can finally have a compact throughout the region that will allow the Western Balkans to move out of this kind of permanent sense of crisis that the region has been stuck in since the conclusion of the Yugoslav wars, or perhaps even arguably since the outbreak of the Yugoslav wars.
So you noted this earlier, how full the plate is right now for the US and the EU just trying to support Ukraine. Do these actors have the capacity to engage in a meaningful way with things possibly growing more fraught between Kosovo and Serbia in the coming months?
You know, it is a significant undertaking. It does require significant attention from government leaders and foreign ministries. But, you know, it's not on the level yet, and one hopes it won't get to the point of a Ukrainian situation where we're having to spend, you know, billions and billions of dollars in arming the Ukrainian defenders against Russian aggression. The point of Western policy in the Western Balkans today needs to be to prevent a still further deterioration in the political and security situation throughout the region. And that requires taking the situation seriously and recognizing the deterioration that we've witnessed over the past decade.
Yasmin Mujanović is a Balkans political analyst and author. He's been speaking with us from Los Angeles. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In many countries, more than 80% of the population has now been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. A lot of African countries are a different story. The continent is lagging behind. Public health experts say misinformation about the vaccines is largely to blame. So now in Ghana and Sierra Leone, to cite two examples, officials are adopting new ways to address the concerns of people who are afraid. Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman begins our next story in the Volta region of eastern Ghana.
Nurse Collins Apisawu has been sitting at this COVID-19 vaccination center in the town of Doje. Sometimes in a day, they only get 5 people to take the jab.
Every day we come here to sit here waiting for them to come and then get jabbed, but they don't come. And We've been here since morning. Not even a single person has come for the job yet, so we are still on it.
Instead of waiting on the other side of this town, Philip Kudaga and his fellow vaccination officers are assembling their equipment. Today, the team led by Kudaga is heading to Deme, one of the remotest villages in the Ketu North municipality. They hop on motorbikes, maneuver on tarred, pothole-ridden roads, and meander through overgrown bushes to get to their destination. Here, Wisdom Bezra sits on a wooden stool, washing his clothes in two big basins in front of him. Bezra says he's skeptical about the safety and efficacy of the COVID-19 vaccines. He finds it mind-boggling that some of the countries with high vaccination rates in Europe and Asia are still recording high cases of the disease.
The advanced countries and the countries that are producing the vaccine, the disease is even more like spreading over there than ours. So why is it like so?
After a long conversation, Kudaga and his team have been able to convince Bezra to take the COVID-19 vaccine, telling him it is safe and will not cause any infertility or other health risks.
Finally, you have taken the jab. How does it feel?
Anyway, it's normal.
It's normal?
Yeah. But I don't know the impact it will have on me in the near future.
Only 25% of Ghana's 31 million people have taken two doses of the vaccines. Vaccinators like Philip Kudaga are up against a lot.
Just imagine walking from throughout the whole community. At the end of the day, you not get anybody to vaccinate. The following day, you are here again. It's frustrating us. People somewhere will think maybe we are not doing our best, but we are putting in our best.
The pushback against COVID-19 vaccines led to over 300,000 vials expiring in the Volta region alone since vaccination began here. But now, COVAX is sending vaccines as they are needed to reduce waste. Dr. Kwesi Jokoto is Ghana Health Services Acting Director for the Volta region. He says the nationwide approach now is to take vaccines directly to the people.
They realize that it is way more economical to go door to door, house to house, kitchen to kitchen, bedroom to bedroom, and ensure that everybody gets vaccinated.
Just like Ghana, Sierra Leone is also adopting a new approach to tackle vaccine hesitancy. At the Lamley Government Hospital in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown, nurse Theodora Bome says they used to record 30 vaccinations a day instead of the 600 daily target. But since they started taking the jabs to public places like the markets and bus terminals, the numbers have started to rise.
We have cancelling them, so that motivates them to come and take the vaccine. So we are having a great number now, because if we sit in the facility, we will not have this kind of numbers.
The government has increased the number of vaccination sites from 72 to 724 across the country. Hesitant Sierra Leoneans like Edmund Ernest Jr. are now responding. The 27-year-old cricketer missed out on so many competitions because he earlier refused to get vaccinated. After one-on-one engagement with health officials, he had a change of mind to get the shot. Now he's urging others to do same.
If you take the vaccine, you are a little bit more safe than you are just an ordinary person without taking the vaccine.
Back in Ghana, other efforts are underway to dispel misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines. Idi Idrisu works in the Department of Social and Behavior Change at the UNESCO office in Ghana. He is leading a team of journalists and social media influencers in a brainstorming session to come up with a radio drama that will dispel misinformation.
They will also feature trusted messages. And trusted messages include doctors, include religious leaders who have a lot of influence at our community level.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization's Fred Osei Sapong says it is dangerous for countries to give up on COVID-19 vaccinations because of hesitancy and low or no risk perceptions among the public.
Remember, this is a virus we are dealing with. Viruses mutate, and they may mutate to a form that may be more virulent to our population.
as Ghana and Sierra Leone begin to see an uptick in their COVID-19 vaccination rate. It is hoped that the rest of West Africa will adopt similar initiatives to ramp up their vaccination drive. For the world, this is Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Ridwan's story is supported by funding from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. 2 weeks ago in Moscow, the American basketball player Brittany Griner was sentenced to 9.5 years in a Russian prison. Griner's lawyers are appealing that sentence. Meanwhile, U.S. and Russian officials are in talks about a potential prisoner swap. The World's Daniel Offman has a story of a man Russia reportedly wants released from a U.S. federal prison.
Viktor Boot is a Russian arms dealer. The 2005 film Lord of War, starring Nicolas Cage, was largely based on Boot's story.
There are over 550 million firearms in worldwide circulation. That's one firearm for every 12 people on the planet. The only question is, how do we arm the other 11?
His reputation as a criminal arms dealer earned him the nickname the Merchant of Death. Boot is currently serving a 25-year sentence for conspiracy to kill U.S. citizens and officials. So why does the Kremlin want him released? CIA Director William Burns was asked that question last month at the Aspen Security Forum.
Why does Putin want Viktor Boot back so badly?
That's a good question, because Viktor Boot's a creep.
Burns went on to say that it's complicated. But Viktor Boot's biography gives some insight.
Viktor Boot's a really bad guy. And he's caused a lot of havoc in the world. He's caused a lot of death in the world.
That's Whitney Schneidman. He was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs during the Clinton administration. At the time, there was a civil war in Angola between government forces and a rebel group called UNITA. Schneidman says he was involved in negotiating a peace deal between the two factions.
Increasingly, this guy named Victor B was mentioned. It was apparent that Victor B was selling arms to the government, and he was selling arms to UNITA, i.e. he was fueling the war that we were trying to end.
And Boot's operation extended far beyond Angola. He shipped weapons all across the globe. Douglas Farah is the co-author of a book about Viktor Boot called Merchant of Death.
What he did was take those wars that were being fought with machetes and hunting rifles and inject AK-47s, rocket-propelled grenades, light anti-tank weapons, attack helicopters into already existing conflicts and just blew them out in terms of scale of how much damage could be done.
Boot speaks multiple languages, and he was an energetic entrepreneur. He gained access to Soviet weapons stockpiles that he could sell on the black market. Russian security services expert Irina Borogan says there's another part of Boot's background that was a key asset for him.
He is a former Soviet military intelligence officer, and he kept close connections with the Russian military intelligence.
After some time, though, the U.S. and other governments went after him. Boot was forced, at least temporarily, to retreat to Russia. But then Schneidman says the U.S. organized a sting operation.
It was in 2008 that the Drug Enforcement Agency lured Viktor Boot from Moscow to a hotel room in Bangkok. These DEA agents wanted to buy arms for him. They were posing as members of the FARC rebels, which is the Colombian rebel groups.
One of the goals of the operation was to connect Boot's weapon sales back to the U.S. They wanted Boot to clearly state that his weapons can hurt and even kill Americans.
And when they said they wanted to buy weapons to kill Americans, and Viktor Boot said, yeah, I'll sell them to you, he broke American law. And right then, agents arrested him, jumped out. The DEA did an incredible, audacious sting.
He was held in a Thai prison for multiple years. In 2010, Boot was extradited to the U.S. and charged with conspiracy to kill U.S. citizens and officials. He served more than 10 years of his prison sentence, which brings us to today.
Россиянина Виктора Бута, который в США приговорен к 25 годам тюрьмы, могут обменять на американцев.
Russian media have been reporting on a potential prisoner swap between the U.S. and Russia. Schneidman says Russia wants him back because he's a high-profile prisoner.
He becomes a propaganda piece for the Russian government to say to the Russian people, look, we saved our national who was being held unfairly, and we won his freedom.
On the U.S. side, there's a debate surrounding these types of prisoner deals. Some say they encourage more unfair detentions, and they also undermine the U.S. justice system. However, Irina Borogan believes that Boot is no longer a threat, so she supports the idea of a swap.
Being a human being, you can't say, no, let this basketballer stay in Russian prison. You can say this. You can't.
Officials from the Biden administration have stated that they've offered the Kremlin a serious proposal, and they've urged the Kremlin to act on it. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
When the war in Ukraine began, many universities and schools there closed, and millions of people fled their homes. Still, learning has not completely stopped. Many students are now taking online classes taught by American professors. Kirk Carapezza with GBH Boston reports that a whole new world of education has opened up for them.
In February, 18-year-old Anna Maslitska was studying at the Kyiv School of Economics when the war came to her family's hometown. A Russian missile hit their neighboring block.
I was supposed to have an English exam. I was preparing for that exam. And then the next day, that all just disappeared. You were figuring out what is more valuable to put in your rucksack to take with you.
The university shut down. Anna and her family fled to Romania before resettling in eastern Spain, where she's rebuilding a new life. With her country in chaos, she's managed to continue her education with remarkably little disruption, taking her courses completely online, including this class, an introduction to Greek and Roman mythology produced by an American company.
And in it, we're going to see wonderful people doing wonderful things and terrible people doing terrible things.
Anna says this is a class she wouldn't have taken before.
These broad stories give us a chance to ask really broad questions about what it means to be human.
Since the start of the war, more than 1,500 Ukrainian colleges and schools have been partially or totally destroyed in what Ukrainian academics say is Russia's deliberate attempt to undermine their ability to teach their own history and culture. Russian soldiers have burned books, libraries, and archives. They've shelled theaters and schools.
The most important thing right now for Ukrainian higher ed is to try to continue in an era when many higher educational institutions have been destroyed.
Alexandra Herzak teaches sociology at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, where her research focuses on Ukraine. Herzak's parents immigrated to the U.S. after the Soviet Army occupied their hometown and declared them and their families enemies of the people. Today, she says the Kremlin is trying to turn back the clock to that era filled with misinformation, indoctrination, and silencing.
Russia really seeks to eliminate Ukraine from the map and replace it with some kind of proxy state.
That's why, she says, Ukrainian professors seeking academic freedom are moving online, using their phones to record violent acts of war, teaching courses from bunkers, and preserving their culture.
There has been a deliberate attempt by Russian occupying forces to expunge textbooks and other kinds of learning materials and replace them with a Russian curriculum that completely erases Ukrainian history.
Higher education is a bulwark against the threat of authoritarianism.
That's Jack DeJoy, president of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. He applauds the way American educators have stepped up to help Ukrainians stay in school. Back in 2020, Georgetown commissioned a study that found education can help tame authoritarian attitudes in the U.S. and abroad. DeJoy says the mission of the American university includes the formation of young people's intellect, the research of faculty, and the contribution to the common good.
These are three inextricably linked elements, but all three contribute to this challenge of responding to the threat of authoritarianism.
In Ukraine, it's estimated that half of all universities switched to online teaching by the end of March, and more are likely to reopen in an online format during this coming academic year. Some American-based education institutions like Coursera and Boston-based edX say they're stepping in to help, allowing students like Anna Maslitska to continue their studies free of charge.
When the unfortunate war started in Ukraine, we felt that we had to act.
Anant Agarwal is founder of edX, a nonprofit company created 10 years ago by computer scientists at MIT and Harvard. In March, edX announced it would work with the Ministry of Education and Science of Ukraine to offer all Ukrainian colleges access to its courses.
These are courses and programs on a platform that the Ukrainian students who are registered at the universities can now take completely for free.
Since February, edX says it's served nearly 3,000 students at more than 40 Ukrainian institutions. The courses are offered in English, however, so only a minority of students can take them. Some of the most popular courses for Ukrainian students include Exercising Leadership and Introduction to Computer Science, both from Harvard, and Advanced Data Structures from New York University. For institutions like the Kyiv School of Economics, which offers mostly business courses, these new broad-based classes mark a major shift.
We reshaped the curriculum.
That's Yegor Stodny, a vice president with the School of Economics. Stodny says the school has resumed some in-person classes, but online courses offered by Ukrainian and American universities have been critical in providing shell-shocked students with more stability and opportunity.
The mental condition of our students was not so good. So we thought that it would be better to maybe make the schedule more flexible.
Students like Anna Mislitska appreciate that flexibility, but they're eager to return to campus.
I want to go home so much, you can't believe.
Stuck in Spain, Mislitska says while she's learning a lot in her Ukrainian and American-based courses online, she wants to return to Kyiv. Like many Ukrainians, she fears that if the educated don't go back to rebuild the country, Ukraine will never fully recover from the war. For The World, Kirk Karapeza, Boston.
Finally today, destination BKO. For those travelers dialed into the three-letter codes given for airports, then you may know that BKO is the airport in Mali's capital, Bamako. BKO is also the name of this band, fitting since Bamako is also the hometown for the members of BKO and the title of their latest single. BKO, the band, formed in 2012, the same year that Mali declared a state of emergency as the country was thrown off course after a coup d'etat brought down the government. BKO stayed focused on the music and attempted a unification of a different kind. They combined two traditional instruments not usually heard together, the djele ngoni, a West African guitar, and the donso ngoni, a six-stringed lute. It is an uncommon pairing. Then again, this rocking number in 4/4 time is also uncommon in Mali. With music sensibilities that go all over the map, BKO, like the airport the band is named after, is a portal to different horizons. That's going to do it for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.